This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 20, 2007. If you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. I'm going to convene an open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Tuesday, November 20th, 2007. The first item on our agenda today involved draft final rules on electioneering communications. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have some late submitted documents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda documents 0776, 0776 A, B, and C.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you can record the Vice Chairman's motion, has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We are here in an effort to promulgate some regulations implementing the Supreme Court's decision in FEC versus Wisconsin Right to Life. That case arose because of a provision in the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, which created a category of advertisements called electioneering communications. And prohibited unions and corporations from funding those kinds of advertisements, which were defined as broadcast advertisements that appeared within 30 days of a primary and 60 days of a general election and that featured a federal candidate. There were some twists and turns and nuances to the rules, but that is it in a nutshell. This agency took a hard line in defending that part of the statute. And we took the position that there were no exemptions to that rule. It was a bright line rule, and we interpreted it in that way. In the Wisconsin Right to Life decision, the Supreme Court told us that we were wrong, and that in fact the Constitution required there to be an exemption for advertisements that fell within the statutory definition, but that were susceptible to no reasonable interpretation other than an appeal to do something other than vote for or against a candidate for federal office. In the intervening 5 months from the point at which the court issued that decision, we have thought through what the implications of that decision were and tried to come up with some regulations that would faithfully implement that decision. Throughout that process, I think the goal of everyone at this table has been to try and provide as much clarity as possible to the regulated community about how we are interpreting that decision. And I think that any step that we take in that direction is positive, and the further we can go down that path, all the better. Many of you, I'm sure, have noticed that over the last several days there have been a variety of different drafts floated out, and we have several of them before us today. I think in part that has been an effort to try and solve the problem of clarity in a number of different ways. Because there is both the problem of how people who want to make advertisements that are permissible under this exemption can do so, and how they can perceive what will trigger an enforcement action by us and what will not. And secondly, internally, for our own desires to have continuity and uniformity in decision making, we have a desire to have a rule that provides sort of a clear outline of how we're going to analyze these cases. So I think we're going to have an interesting discussion today. I think that there are a lot of very strong views about how we should proceed, and my hope is at the end of it we will have a rule that will achieve that goal of clarity. Mr. Vice Chairman, do you have any thoughts to begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to discuss a little bit the process that we've been through in the last few days even, not to mention the last couple of months, which I have found to be helpful and illuminating. It's a little bit difficult dealing with putting something out and getting, in some case, actual ex parte communications that we are placing on the record, and in other cases, comments on publicly available sites and having to deal with them. But I thought that was important because I have been through the experience before of working on something here in the commission which involves a lot of conversations, and then the reduction of words to writing, and what inevitably happens in that process is the understandings that we bring to the words from based on our conversations among ourselves are not evident from the words themselves. And I think that's been part of the problem over the last several days when people looked at a redraft of the regulation, at least to the comments that we've seen, mostly reacted negatively. And I think that's actually been productive because it's allowed us to see how people are understanding this and at least have us try to calibrate it. I wanted to comment, though, on why I think it's important for us to include factors or facts in the rule along the lines that the draft released last week did. And start off by noting that it's remarkable to me that commenters as diverse as Bob Bauer, Jim Bopp, Rick Hasen, Paul Ryan, Mr. Ryan's with us today, all oppose the incorporation of those factors into the rule. And yet those were the factors that Chief Justice Roberts himself used in applying the no other reasonable interpretation test. Now, it's true that those factors were a discussion of the application of that test to a specific ad, but that's because this was an as-applied challenge. Now, if the commission isn't going to use the factors that Chief Justice Roberts himself used in applying the general test, then what factors are we going to use? And I think we're obligated to say that. In other words, I think the no reasonable interpretation test standing all alone is insufficiently descriptive of either a standard or a process by which we would come to a decision. And one of the things that's apparent to me is that all of us, either both as the commission and people outside, bring to this an understanding that each reader has of how that test is supposed to work. And it's in the context of their own understanding that they look at a set of factors that are laid out in a commission rule and they go, oh, no, that's not right, because each of the five of us who happen to be on the commission right now would had a different view going into it about what ought to be in there and how it ought to be laid out. And I suspect that everyone on the outside had that same assumption. And so the problem, in my view, of having a general rule and a fairly narrow safe harbor, which is in essence what was presented in the original draft, is that it did not make the difficulty in interpretation go away. It just buried it. It covered it up. Because the fact of the matter is that we're not going to have the easy case come before the commission. I mean, we may have a complaint about an easy case, and we'll dismiss it at the RTB stage, and essentially it won't be controversial. We're going to have a hard test. One of the commenters said, well, gosh, you shouldn't go beyond WRTL. Shouldn't go beyond where the Supreme Court went. And yet the one thing we know absolutely for certain is that we're going to go beyond WRTL. We are. And it's this commission that's going to be called upon in the first instance to go beyond it. Now, in 13 days, the electioneering communication period for the Iowa caucuses kicks in. And about 14 days from now, it's likely that somebody's going to run an ad that will fall within statutory parameters, and people are going to have questions about it. And it won't be the Supreme Court. It'll be us that probably in the first instance, I mean, somebody could file an as-applied challenge or try to get a declaratory injunction in a district court, but I doubt they're going to do that. I think it'll be us in the first instance. And so we're going to go beyond WRTL, and the question is when we're going to do it and how we're going to do it. And I think we are better off trying to lay out a decision path and a set of factors that we're going to consider when we do that, because we will. And by the way, if we have them wrong, well, so be it. Our rule itself, of course, is subject to challenge. But I think we'll be better off in three ways by putting these kind of factors into the rule. The first is predictability that the chairman talked about. For someone who corporation or union who wants to speak, they will have more guidance rather than less about what they can say. The second is the commission itself. When we had commenters talk about particular ads during the hearing, we had a great deal of certainty on the part of the commenters as to where those ads fit and whether they were in or out of the safe harbor or the general rule, but we had complete disagreement between the commenters and reasonable people, demonstrably reasonable people, saying absolutely no question this one is regulated, and another reasonable person saying absolutely no question that other one's not regulated. And the commission, of course, is going to be in the same position. When Mr. Ryan sits down with his colleagues at the Campaign Legal Center, or Mr. Bopp or Mr. Bauer sit down with their colleagues at the law firm, they're talking with people who have a relatively homogeneous range of views and philosophical presumptions. Not uniform, I know, but relatively homogeneous. The commission doesn't have that luxury. We're a bipartisan commission. We come at things from widely divergent views, presuppositions, assumptions, and so on like that. And it's frequently very hard to come to consensus. And we, the commission, is going to be a lot better off if we have a path that lays out, here are the factors we're going to consider, and here's how we're going to do it. It won't solve every case, won't resolve every hard call, but at least we'll focus our decisions. And the third advantage to laying out these factors is that it will facilitate judicial review. Now, I know that, in essence, if this is viewed as an interpretation of a Supreme Court opinion, that we'll get very little, perhaps no deference, in terms of our construction of how this rule works. I suspect we'll get some deference. But having laid out a rule and then an application, when it comes time for a court to review it, the court will understand what we did and why we did it much better than if we simply come up with an interpretation based on a no reasonable interpretation, no other reasonable interpretation test, and pop out a conclusion. And so I think for all of those reasons, it's important to put factors into a rule, so that I'm going to support doing that. I just want to briefly mention I have circulated an agenda document. I believe it's designated as C, which I don't intend to offer, but I simply want to put out because some people are in favor of having an election czar. And if I were the election czar, this is what the rule would look like. So it's for two purposes. One, to show how I read the Supreme Court opinion. I acknowledge, by the way, that is not a reading that many people would share, but I think it's a logical reading. And to show that the other proposals before us are genuinely the result of compromise. I didn't get what I wanted. I don't think any one commissioner is going to get what they want out of that process. I think it shows some of the difficulties that would be encountered if we don't put factors in a rule. Because if we don't put factors in a rule, then I'm going to come at it more or less as I laid out in my proposal, and other commissioners will come at it in very different ways.
Very good. Thank you. It causes me to puzzle somewhat, though, whether the election czar gets election Cossacks, what that would look like. Commissioner Weintraub, do you...
I try to stay away from Cossacks and czars, for that matter. It's another line from Fiddler on the Roof. May God bless and keep the czar far away from us. And there are probably a lot of people who feel that way about an election czar. when we started this, I thought this was going to be easy because I figured, Chief Justice Roberts told us what to do, so hey, how hard could it be? But of course, the devil is always in the details. And I don't think the question is actually whether we're going to use the factors that Chief Justice Roberts set out in his opinion, but rather how we're going to use them. I think we all want to fairly apply both the law and the Supreme Court's interpretation of the law. But of course, as has been noted, we have different views about how that happens. I personally was pretty comfortable with the proposal in the NPRM, in the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, that set out the Roberts test as a general rule and provided a safe harbor for communications that pretty much followed along the lines of the Wisconsin Right to Life ad and used those factors that Chief Justice Roberts laid out in his opinion. I didn't think that was such a bad idea, but it wasn't going to get four votes, it turned out. So that's why we moved on and tried to come up with another approach. And I agree with my colleagues that really the only purpose to this is to provide clarity. So for me, the key question here is, are we at the end of the day going to end up with a rule that both fairly interprets the Supreme Court and the law and provides clarity and more guidance to the regulated community than they would get from just reading the Supreme Court opinion. Because if we're not going to add to that, then I'm not sure, you know, why we should bother. And worse yet, if we're going to confuse people, if we're going to put forward a rule that actually leaves the regulated community scratching their heads and not able to figure out what we're talking about, then that would be the worst possible result. And it actually looked like, out of the best intentions, we were heading in that direction. You know, we sat down with the best of intentions and tried to come up with a compromise and thought we knew what we were doing. And when it went out to the public, people from a broad variety of viewpoints said, "What's that? That doesn't make a lot of sense." And I think they had different reasons for why they thought it didn't make a lot of sense, but clearly they thought that it didn't. And what should have been obvious, I suppose, to us all along, but it shows the danger of sitting and talking amongst yourselves too much and not getting out of the building and hearing what other people have to say. What should have been obvious to us but wasn't to me until I read the comments a couple of times was that we were being circular in our logic. We were taking the test, the overall Roberts test of susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation, and incorporating that almost as part of the definition of itself, so that we said, as an overall matter, we're going to have we're going to look at ads to see whether they're susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation, or NORI, as Mr. Bopp has dubbed it, and if in defining what that would mean, we're going to look at whether there are indicia of express advocacy and whether there's another reasonable interpretation of the words. Well, that goes back to the overall question. So once you get to another reasonable interpretation, which we had defined by, you know, in terms of commercial purpose or grassroots lobbying, once you've found that other reasonable interpretation, it seemed that we were rendering the part of the test that talked about the indicia of express advocacy superfluous. You wouldn't have to get there because, by definition, you would have already found that other reasonable interpretation. This is incredibly confusing, and I cannot imagine how anybody who is unfortunate enough to be watching this on C-SPAN and doesn't have all these documents in front of them and hasn't read the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking could possibly figure this out, but then it's possible that only my mother is actually watching on C-SPAN, and I can explain it to her later. Hi, Mom. Anyway, that was my perspective that yesterday when I realized that we were just confusing people and confusing people from a wide variety of perspectives and rightfully confusing them. It wasn't that they weren't getting it. It's that we got it wrong in the first place. And that's what caused me to put out an alternative proposal that went back closer to the NPRM language. And I didn't go back to the same language because I knew that wasn't going to get 4 votes. So I tried another iteration of that, which I hoped would be might get some votes, although I actually am not aware of any other commissioner who would vote for it besides me. It's, you know, that gets 1 vote, which I don't know, maybe the NPRM would get 2 votes, but I think that's unfortunate because when I did put it on our website, I heard back both through notices on other people's websites and from one-line ex parte communication from Jim Bopp, which I fully disclose here today, that Jim Bopp liked my proposal, Paul Ryan liked my proposal, Bob Bauer sort of liked my proposal, although he liked the NPRM better. And actually, I can't think of the last time that Paul Ryan and Jim Bopp agreed on anything at all. So it's remarkable to me that I got the two of them to agree, and I can't pick up one more vote at the table. But, you know, that's the way it works sometimes. So as we go forward, I don't know whether I'm going to bother to offer the motion since just to see whether I pick up another vote, but I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get 4 votes for it. And then the question for me as I listen to my colleagues going forward today is going to be whether I think that a document that could get 4 votes will provide the kind of clarity that the regulated community needs. And I'm not sure about that at this point, but, you know, maybe I'll be persuaded.
Very good. There's hope. Commissioner Von Spakovsky, would you like to have some opening words?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The rule we're considering today will implement the Supreme Court's decision, Wisconsin Right to Life, which held that the funding prohibition on electioneering communications in the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, or BCRA, is unconstitutional when applied to a communication that may reasonably be interpreted as something other than an appeal to vote for or against a candidate. This decision by the Supreme Court has restored the constitutional significance of the line between campaign speech and issue speech that the Court's McConnell decision had blurred. And I take great solace in the Chief Justice's reaffirmation that, quote, in drawing that line, the First Amendment requires us to err on the side of protecting political speech rather than suppressing it. Last year, I urged the Commission to adopt a regulatory fix that would have exempted this kind of grassroots lobbying communications. That proposal was defeated. But now the Supreme Court has given us a broader, constitutionally based exemption that we have to implement. What the Court has told us is that not every communication that's captured by the electioneering communication provision in BCRA can be constitutionally regulated. Only those communications that are the functional equivalent of express advocacy. And according to the Supreme Court, a communication that's the functional equivalent of express advocacy only if it's susceptible to no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. Our task today is to adopt a resolution that implements the Supreme Court's new test in a way that makes it possible for the public to know with a high degree of certainty when they can speak freely on an issue and when they cannot. The exemption language that we have before us, the latest version that the chairman has circulated, I believe does that, but I'm under no illusions that we will not still be facing very tough decisions, as the vice chairman has outlined. I mean, this rule, if we adopt it, only gets us part of the way to implementing what the Supreme Court has given to us in its First Amendment decision. The time's going to come when we have to decide the fate of a communication that presents a really difficult determination under this test. When that time comes, I intend to be guided by the Court's admonition that the tie goes to the speaker, not the censor, and that we have to give the benefit of doubt to speech, not censorship. I suspect I'll be criticized by some when I put that intention into practice, but our rights to free speech and to petition the government that are enshrined in the First Amendment are precious rights not enjoyed by millions of people around the world, and I will do everything I can as a commissioner to preserve those rights. Now, there are two approaches before us today. The first would place the new exemption within the Commission's definition of electioneering communications. Under this approach, an advertisement that fits the Supreme Court's test would not constitute an electioneering communication and therefore would not be subject to either the funding prohibitions that are in the campaign finance law or any new disclosure requirements. Under the second proposal, the exemption would be placed within the Commission's corporate and labor union funding regulations. Under this approach, an advertisement that satisfies the Supreme Court's exemption would still qualify as an electioneering communication, but it would no longer be prohibited, and a corporation or labor union could finance it with general treasury funds. But a complicated new disclosure regime would be applied to this. I believe that the Supreme Court's decision calls for us to adopt a proposal that places this exemption within the definition of electioneering communication. I'm sympathetic to the motivation behind placing the exemption within the corporate and labor union reporting provisions, the most significant of which is that the Commission should do no more than what the Court required. In fact, I agree with that. I fully acknowledge that the Supreme Court in the Wisconsin Right to Life decision did not directly address BCRA's electioneering communication disclosure provisions. But it's also indisputable that the Court did not direct us to create a new reporting system for a category of communications that previously had been banned and that Congress never envisioned. In supporting this approach, I'm not motivated by any animus towards reporting and disclosure in general. Transparency in elections is a good thing. And there's no doubt that disclosure of the funding of election-related speech is required. But the Supreme Court said in this decision that this is not election-related speech. I am motivated by my understanding of the Commission's function, which is to interpret and administer, not to legislate. A requirement that advertisements that are constitutionally exempt from our regulation under the Wisconsin Right to Life decision should still have their funding reported is a requirement that can only be implemented by Congress, not the FEC. The Supreme Court stated very clearly that, quote, this court has never recognized a compelling interest in regulating ads like Wisconsin Right to Life's that are neither express advocacy nor its functional equivalent. And the Supreme Court has never before upheld under the federal campaign finance laws the mandatory disclosure of issue advocacy. Basically, the court in this decision held that the electionary communication provision cannot be applied to issue ads because they're not electoral campaign activity. We therefore have no authority to impose regulations on such speech. This is the statutory code that we have to live by. And nowhere in here are we charged with administering or regulating in any manner the non-electoral speech or activities of individuals and organizations that are neither candidates nor political committees. And I don't think it's the Commission's proper role to place this novel concept in our regulations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Thank you. Commissioner Walther, any opening thoughts?
In order to get on with the merits, I'll make it short. We have found ourselves, as most of you know, in a difficult position of trying to reconcile some very diverse views by five commissioners who have very diverse views. And not only in Congress, in connection with the philosophy underlying McCain-Feingold, but of course on the Supreme Court, who had quite divergent views. And we now are found ourselves trying to divine the intent of the court through one opinion by the Chief Justice. And the Chief Justice, thankfully, gave regardless of our philosophy, gave guidance to a significant degree, not always present in some opinions. And the regulations that we are about to adopt today, assuming we can get that far, will track quite closely to the guidance that was given there. So in the absence of regulations, I think counsel would still have quite a bit of guidance from the opinion, if the counsel was educated on the opinion, to advise a client fairly safely. But our regulations are to try and divine with more detail what came from the opinion in our view and give guidance as much as anything on what we'll do with it. And I think Vice Chairman Mason made the very good point that we've attempted to figure out how we would grapple with the issues that come before us and give guidance on the approach that we would take. And that's not been easy because we haven't done it yet. But we have worked through a variety of iterations, and I want to compliment the chairman and the rest of my colleagues as well. But it befell the chairman to really help guide us through a maze of different considerations and ways in which to phrase things and orders in which we would state priorities to try and find whatever common ground we can and still get the job done. And everybody, I think, has worked very carefully in a collegial manner to see what we could do, notwithstanding those views. And secondly, I'd like to say if anyone doubts that we don't look outside this office for a thoughtful comment, they would be quite wrong. This is especially a good case. We have a tremendous reservoir of intellect and a constructive thought out there that we definitely need to read and understand and think about, and it really makes a big difference in the way we approach our job, notwithstanding the many drafts that have been filed here. The lodestone for me really is to try and divine the opinion and then preserve as much of McCain-Feingold and its intent as possible. I think that the draft that was proposed by the chairman late this morning is one that is the best composite for us at this point, and I intend to support that. I also intend to support an ongoing obligation to report. I know that's controversial. I'm quite sympathetic to the views of Commissioner Von Spakovsky on this. But on the other hand, none of this reporting implication was before the court. I don't see an intimation from the Chief Justice that reporting was to be scooped up in the thrust of its the opinion of the court. That reporting is the bedrock of transparency, and transparency is the bedrock of McCain-Feingold and its underlying philosophy, and has quite a different test when it comes to upholding regulations or laws relating to disclosure as opposed to those which prohibit communications. So I intend to support the draft that would provide for reporting. So at this point, I suggest we get on with the business of the day.
Very good. Thank you. And I'd like to touch or reemphasize a couple of points that were raised by some of the commissioners, initially by the vice chairman and Commissioner Weintraub, which dealt with the evolution of the documents. And I think that both of them are really correct. I mean, the difference between in the phraseology of how the commission was going to handle matters that didn't fall within the safe harbor, the difference in the phraseology that came from draft B that was released, I believe, last Friday, and the document I circulated today, was not so much a change in the thinking of the commission, but much more a change in how we phrased our thinking. And I do think that it was the product of public reaction and people who had not been on the ninth floor here, sorting through these problems over the last 5 months. It was the reaction of people outside of this building to the words we had chosen that caused us to rethink and rephrase our approach more than change our approach. And I think that was very helpful for us and for the regulated community. I think the document that I circulated today, which, while it bears my name, is really the product of input and compromise of many people. But the document that I circulated today much more fairly reflects the approach that this commission would take in matters that fall outside of the safe harbor. The second thing I wanted to touch on was Commissioner Weintraub's proposal, because in the initial NPRM and in the document that she circulated, there is, I think, a very helpful feature, which is a clear articulation of the kinds of ads that the commission will not seek enforcement actions on. And I think that the presence of a safe harbor is helpful for organizations and individuals outside of this building who are trying to discern what kinds of activities would truly be safe. But it certainly was never envisioned and does not encompass all of the speech that would be protected under Chief Justice Roberts' test. And I think that the thing that the changes that have been made, the additions that have been made that deal with the broader problem of how this commission is going to approach problems, ads that fall outside of the safe harbor, is also enormously important. Because I think that one of the problems we had with the NPRM's approach was we gave no guidance whatsoever with how this commission was going to analyze ads that did not fall within the safe harbors. And I think that very helpful steps have been made to try and articulate the intellectual process or the analytical process the commission will go through in trying to discern whether ads that don't fall within the safe harbor do meet the Chief Justice's test or not. And I think the addition of that part of the regulation is enormously helpful as guidance. And simultaneously serves the benefit of trying to provide increased continuity to our decision making. The last point I wanted to touch on very briefly was disclosure. I think Commissioner Von Spakovsky makes a very good case, and I think there are sound reasons for the position he holds. I don't share it, in part for the reasons that he articulated, and that the Supreme Court did not address it, and the constitutional standards would be different than the one that was used in the Wisconsin Right to Life decision. And so there was a little less clarity for us there as to how the court would come out in that context. And in part because we have a statute that requires disclosure for ads that fall within the bright lines tests of an electioneering communications. There's a third feature that fits into my thinking on this somewhat as well. And that is, both in the Buckley decision and in the Wisconsin Right to Life decision, the Supreme Court made clear that the requirements of the First Amendment and the protections of the First Amendment swept broadly and consequently provided protections to ads that had an electoral purpose and could appropriately be regulated, but because of the needs of the First Amendment and the needs of protection of speech, that some of those ads would not fall within the regulatory regime. And in this context, an awareness that there are ads that appropriately could be regulated and consequently appropriately be disclosed speaks to me for a need to continue the disclosure regime in this particular context, at least until the statute changes or we get better guidance from the court that there is a constitutional limitation on disclosure in this area. I think that we have tried to recognize that the somewhat different organizational structure and purposes of entities that are now swept under this regime in the regulations we prepared, but I think as a core element, I continue to support disclosure even of communications that might otherwise be exempt. Other thoughts, comments? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a motion, and I'm going to make the motion off of your circulated document. So I believe that's 07-76-B?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, that amends, I believe, only a captures only a portion. Yeah, so I think my document amends only a portion of the core document 07-76. If I'm correct in that, and as a consequence, your motion would have, or I guess you could move the this particular document, but there may be that it wouldn't cover the core reporting issues.
Yeah, what I wanted to say about this, Mr. Chairman, is I agree with the way you have laid out the way the exemption would work,
okay,
and the test that we would use to determine whether an electioneering communication is actually election-related speech or it is not. The only thing that I disagree with is the placement of it. I mean, the document that you've put together here would place this in Regulation 1114, which is where we deal with corporate labor unions, as opposed to placing it in 100.29, which deals with the definition of electioneering communications. And all of it I have no problems with, except for the very final paragraph in the document, which then also lays out what the reporting requirement would be. And I believe we have the votes to me, this whole thing falls down into two separate issues. I mean, one is the language describing the test and the safe harbor, the exemption. The second issue is the disclosure requirement. And what I would propose that we do is to have a vote to approve the language describing the exemption without deciding the issue of in which regulatory part it goes, and then have a separate vote on that issue and whether the disclosure provision should be placed in it. And that way, I think we can, even if we disagree on the funding issue, we can at least have an exemption language out there that the regulated community is going to be able to see and know what they can and can't do starting, was it 14 days? 13 days from now. Lucky number for us today. So I'm going to make a motion, Mr. Chairman, that we adopt the language in your provision with the amendment that we, for the moment, drop out that this is in 114.15, and that we drop out paragraph F and simply adopt the rest of the language as the exemption and the test that applies.
Okay. Very good. Madam Secretary, is the Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion sufficiently clear? Would you like it? Very good. Discussion on the motion. Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm not sure it's clear to me because I'm not sure how this works. I'm not sure if we, and I'd be interested in our counsel's advice, whether we can adopt language sort of freestanding, not to go into any particular part of the Federal Register, but just sort of hanging out there. And what would happen then if we didn't have agreement on where to put it? Who gets to answer that lucky question?
Well, I think perhaps, Commissioner Weintraub, the answer is that there would ultimately have to be an agreement as to where to put it before we send it off to the Federal Register and tell them which particular section it's amending. I think it may be possible to agree to something in concept, but then as to where it's placed might require some technical changes so that we know whether it's paragraph A of this section versus if it's starting in paragraph C of a different section, those kinds of things. If that's helpful.
Yes, I'm sure Commissioner Von Spakovsky anticipates there will be subsequent motions, maybe to place it in other parts of the regulations, were his motion to not succeed.
That would come as no surprise to me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Commissioner Walther.
If I understand, then if we were to vote on the motion, I just would want to make it clear that we would be considering it basically as was said in concept, but that if we were to deadlock on where it went, that vote would basically be of interest only, have no legal effect. And I think this is an important point to make. It's a step toward a direction, but if we don't get to the final step, then this first step is just a vote.
Yeah, and I think that presumably, you know, were this motion to be adopted and we were to have adopted this particular regulatory language, a subsequent motion could presumably be made that would incorporate this into Agenda Document 07-76, and that might be a means by which we could find a place within the regulatory construct for this particular language. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's fine to cut to the chase, and we won't go through the charade of having everybody vote for their favorite proposal that we know won't get four votes. As people are talking, I've been sitting here scribbling to see whether there's something that I can do with this that might gain support and that I would be willing to support. Because my fundamental problem with the way this is laid out, again, goes to the redundancy in the language on whether something has another reasonable interpretation or doesn't, and where that language occurs, and whether there's some way that we can finesse this a little bit so that it becomes clear that the indicia of express advocacy is not a superfluous factor, that it's fully part of the test and has to be considered, assuming that something doesn't fall into the safe harbor. And I'm not sure whether this does it, and I'm not sure whether other people would be interested in this, but I wanted to try it. So I prefer not to do this on the fly at the table, but, you know, that's where we are. So I would like to suggest on page 2 of your blue document, Mr. Chairman, see what people would think about this. An amendment to line 6 and 7 that would read, I'll start reading from the beginning of the paragraph so people can follow it a little bit better. If a communication does not qualify for the safe harbor in paragraph B, the commission will consider whether the communication includes any indicia of express advocacy and here's where my change kicks in, and what other content the communication contains, going down to line 8, in order to determine whether, on balance, the communication is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified federal candidate. Again, the idea would be to prevent this language about no reasonable interpretation or no interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified candidate coming up in more than one place so as to obviate the indicia of express advocacy down in the analysis. And again, I'm not 100% sure this does it. On line 16 and 17.
I'm sorry, Ellen, could you go back and tell me again what the change is?
I think we almost did.
It's a change to line 6 to 8 on page 2.
That's it.
Okay? Under rules of interpretation. So the paragraph would read, if a communication does not qualify for the safe harbor in paragraph B, the commission will consider whether the communication includes any indicia of express advocacy and, this is where it starts, and what other content the communication contains. Go to line 8. In order to determine whether, on balance, the communication is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified federal candidate.
And then you change to 16, yeah.
And then there would be a change on line 16 and 17. Again, the problem being that if we say that a communication has this interpretation other than an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified federal candidate, and I appreciate the deletion of the word reasonable to try and clarify it, then it suggests that you don't even need to address paragraph 1 about the indicia of express advocacy because you've already determined that there's another interpretation and that fits into the Roberts overall test. So what I'm suggesting is a change to line 16 and 17 so that it would read, two, content that would support a determination that a communication has an interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified federal candidate includes content that, and I can read that again.
So what, yeah, was yeah. It, I'm sorry, content that would?
Content that would support a determination that. Would be the lead into the sentence. So it would read content that would support a determination that a communication has an interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified federal candidate includes content that, and then the rest of it would be the same. And the purpose of this, and I've been, you know, chairman sitting there thinking, why didn't you come up with this 2 hours ago?
That wasn't what I was thinking.
I've been trying to muddle through this language to figure out if there's a way that I could think of to make clear that it is and remains a two-part analysis, and that the finding the indicia of express advocacy, whether that's there or that's not, is an important piece of it. Now, I think that it's not the end of the analysis. I think that we can imagine ads that would include indicia of express advocacy, but they would be okay. And to modify one that Mr. Bopp has suggested, if someone were to run an ad saying, it's really important that everyone get out to vote, you know, looking back at the last election, whether you support John Kerry or George Bush, this election is really important to America, so everyone should get out and vote on November, whatever the date of the election was. And that would include indicia of express advocacy because it would talk about voting, it would mention the election day, it would mention the candidate, so it wouldn't fall into our safe harbor. But I think that everybody would probably agree that that's not the kind of ad that ought to be restricted if somebody wants to do that kind of generic get out and vote for whoever your favorite candidate is. So I think there are circumstances when that wouldn't be determinative, but it's still something that we'd want to look at. And therefore, I want to make sure that if all we have is that something focuses on a public policy issue and urges a candidate to take a position on the issue or urges the public to contact the candidate about the issue, that that doesn't become the end of the analysis. So that's what I'm trying to do anyway. I'm not sure whether this does it, but that's what I'm trying to do. I just thought I'd throw that out there since I've been sitting here scribbling at the table and see whether there's any takers for that one. Or if anybody wants to suggest something, you know, better.
Okay. Thoughts on Commissioner Weintraub's suggestions? Vice Chairman Mason.
I don't have any immediately, but I view the effort as productive, and let me say that, and say because I think one of the things it illustrates is the point that I had meant to make and Commissioner Weintraub just made, which is that our problem is precisely this: the things that don't fall into the safe harbor and that do have indicia of express advocacy. And in my view, the proper reading of the way Chief Justice Roberts applied this test is essentially in two parts. Call it two prongs or two inquiries or I don't know just what, because it's clear to me anyway that the indicia of express advocacy is kind of one type of inquiry, and the other reasonable purpose is a different type. And they're different in interesting ways, because to my mind, the indicia of express advocacy pretty much covers the waterfront. It's very broad, as Commissioner Weintraub has illustrated. Any opposing candidate, just saying Republican or Democrat, or mentioning an election or voting. And so this is a very broad, and I really can't imagine anything that's not in that list. It's not fairly encompassed within that list, including taking a position on a candidate's character, qualifications, or fitness for office, that we would need to worry about in terms of what would need to be regulated. And that's why in my proposal I said, well, if there's no indicia at all, we don't have to worry about it. In contrast, the no other reasonable interpretation is sort of the more difficult part, because we're trying to describe a set that includes every other activity in the world other than voting for a particular candidate. It's very clear that grassroots lobbying is one such activity. I think everyone on the commission agrees that that commercial activity is another category, and that there are almost certainly some other communications, such as the types that some of the nonprofit groups described in their. I mean, for instance, I could easily imagine an ad urging people to get a particular health screening procedure, you know, get a cancer test or something like that, or for heart disease or whatever, and you know, to be whimsical, so Republicans and Democrats agree that everyone should, you know, and it may well be that in a particular election context, a health organization would want to use the attention to the election, you know, before you vote, get tested for whatever, to promote this, and might even want to use candidates to do that. So I think that's the more difficult, you know, side of the analysis to try to conduct. And again, this is, you know, the problem that we're going to face. But I do agree with the overall approach that, as the Chief Justice laid out these factors, we're going to have to look at facts like that as we apply this to a particular ad. And I agree that one way or another, we're going to have to look at all at both sides of that, at the indicia of express advocacy side, and at the other reasonable interpretation side. And the problem, I think the biggest problem that's going to come before the commission, is when there is something in there, some call that arguably is a reasonable interpretation for the ad, that isn't very strong. And I think the example would be the Bill Yellowtail ad, which is the one ad that everybody seems to agree is regulated under the Roberts test. If that ad included a call to call Bill Yellowtail and tell him to support a named piece of legislation, and I suspect there would be very substantial disagreement among commenters, experts, so on like that, as to what we would do in a case like that. And what we have been trying to do one way or the other through Commissioner Weintraub's suggestion and the chairman's suggestion is to describe how we would approach that decision in just a case like that. And one way or another, I agree we would be looking at both sides of it.
Other thoughts? I mean, my sense in thinking this through, one of the things we spend a lot of time doing here is thinking through the implications of language and context other than the most obvious one. And one of the hard things about doing this at the table is that there's less time to sort of think through the meanings of these phrases. And I guess sort of as I look at it now, I don't have much concern, and arguably it's an improvement to make the changes suggested on line 16, C2. I'm less I like the changes on at C, lines 6 through 8, because it moves away from the concreteness of the language there. And right now there the language is concretely referring down to what appears as little subpart 2. If we take the language, if we replace it with the language you suggested, that isn't actually referring to the language you use later on. It's similar to it but different, and therefore I would prefer to stay with what we have 6 through 8, on line 6 through 8 at the top of page 2 there, if it were possible. I'm sorry, Commissioner Walther.
First of all, it's difficult at the table, after what we've been through, to try and analyze, as the chairman says, exactly where it gets us in terms of where we've been. So I'm reluctant to make many changes without some thought on this. I will say that if we were to do that, I don't see any difficulty at this point with respect to the phraseology on subparagraph 2 for the same reasons the chairman said. But up above, we added this morning a solution to what I was concerned about in a previous draft, and that is how you reconcile subparagraph 2 with subparagraph 1, because under our drafts A and B that we filed before, they seem to be starkly alone. And so if you got to B, what difference did it make if there was A? Or 2, what difference did it make if there was 1? But today, with the modification in the chairman's draft, we make it clear that it's a balancing test. We balance one against the other, and then we take a look at the last phrase, and that says whether the communication is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified candidate. I'd like to see that language stay intact after all we've been through. The second part, if it's the will of the commission, I could see that.
Thank you, Annette. Yes. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, if I could bring us back to the to my motion then, if Commissioner Weintraub is proposing two changes, I would not consider the first change as a friendly amendment. So this would leave intact the provisions in 6 and 8 as Commissioner, I agree with Commissioner Walther and what you've said about that. But I would consider a friendly amendment the second change on line 16.
Okay. We also have a time-honored tradition here of the five-minute recess. If people would like some time to think about that, or you may have reached a conclusion. So. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason why I wanted to change it in both places is that we are leaning rather heavily in that C paragraph on lines 4 to 10 on the difference between a communication that's susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified federal candidate, and a communication that has an interpretation, not a reasonable interpretation, but an interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a clearly identified federal candidate. It's very, very similar, and I'm not sure if taking out that one word reasonable can really bear the weight that we are putting on it. And as I said, the downside is that paragraph one, it's funny because I think Commissioner Walther and I have the same concern. I want to make sure that paragraph one remains a vital part of the test and is not obviated by a determination that, well, if there's an interpretation other than an appeal to vote for against a clearly identified federal candidate, then it falls under Justice Roberts' test that as long as it's susceptible, you can only regulate it if it is susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation. And once you determine there is a reasonable interpretation, then you really don't need to go any further. So that's what I'm trying to get at.
And I guess I share your concern, but I just thought that the language had achieved that end in part because to reach the status of a reasonable if a communication has no other interpretation, then it's a simpler call. If there's an indicia of express advocacy and one can think of no interpretation, reasonable or unreasonable, as to what it might be saying other than an appeal to elect or defeat that, then I think it's an easy call and it doesn't end up being a big problem. If there is some sort of an appeal and you're seeking an effort to determine whether it can reasonably be construed as something other than a call to vote for or against someone, it would seem that you know, weighing the indicia of express advocacy and the reasonableness of that appeal would be the means by which you would achieve that process intellectually. And so I think I don't think we're far apart on, I don't think we have differences as to how all of this plays itself out. And I think that the reason why there's a lot of weight being put on those words is those are the ones that are the controlling words in the Chief Justice's opinion. And so it seemed relying upon those, hewed us as closely as possible to the point we were trying to reach. Walther.
At the present, then, do I understand before the commission to be the vote of Commissioner Von Spakovsky accepting as a friendly amendment the revised language under subparagraph 2, which is on page 2, line 16?
Commissioner Von Spakovsky has a motion before us. He has indicated that he would treat the language that Commissioner Weintraub had proposed at line 16 as a friendly amendment. We are now sort of at a point where Commissioner Weintraub is thinking through whether that would be sufficient for her to support this or not. So that's the state of the play. We're going to call a short 5-minute recess. Thank you. Thank you. We'll reconvene the meeting of the Federal Election Commission for November 20th and continue our discussion on regulations to implement the Supreme Court's decision in Wisconsin Right to Life. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the break. And I thank all of my colleagues for considering last-minute amendments. None of us except Commissioner Mason were here when the original BICRA rules were written, but I understand there were many long nights of writing regulations at the table, so this is just a small taste of what went on.
And at least three lawsuits followed.
Well, <it's laughs> that does give me pause. It's not the best way of writing regulations.
Time for the 10-minute recess.
But I appreciate my colleagues being willing to incorporate the amendment that I suggested at lines 16 to 17, and I think that really does accomplish my goal of ensuring that looking at whether a communication has focuses on a public policy issue or proposes a commercial transaction is not going to be the end of the analysis. It is just content that would support a determination, but as the introductory paragraph makes clear, one also has to consider indicia of express advocacy. So I will vote for that.
Very good. So Commissioner Von Spakovsky, I understand that you would treat that as a friendly amendment to your motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And Madam Secretary, is Commissioner Weintraub's language for line 16 clear?
Yes.
Very good. So other discussion on the motion. Commissioner Weintraub.
I'll just add that another factor that weighs in the balance for me is that by we're in the unusual circumstance of voting for language that doesn't have an ENJ attached to it, and by voting for the document, I get to participate in the drafting of the ENJ to try and further ensure that what I believe is all of our intent actually is fully effectuated in the explanation and justification.
Yes, and I think we are in the same place. The question is simply one of phraseology. Other discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Other motions? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make another motion now that we have the exemption language, which was one of our biggest tasks in this effort. And my motion is that we place this exemption into our regulations at 100.29, which contains the definition of electioneering communications, and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any technical conforming changes that are necessary to fit this regulatory language that we have just adopted into that regulation.
Very good. And for those unversed in our regulatory structure, the consequence of that this motion would be that were it to be adopted, it would fit within a part of the regulations which does not require disclosure of electioneering communications which fall within the exemption. Discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion. Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion fails by a vote of 2-3, with the Vice Chairman and Commissioner Von Spakovsky voting in favor, and myself, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Walther voting against. Other motions. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will move instead that we put this language into Section 114, which would preserve disclosure.
Okay. And so I think put somewhat more formally, I think this would be a motion to adopt draft B of agenda document 07-76 with the amendment that the language in draft B relating to section 114.15, which appears on page 10 beginning at about line 7, would be replaced and amended with the language which appears in agenda document 07-76B, as amended by Commissioner Weintraub's amendment earlier. Commissioner Weintraub.
And I just want to make sure, because I know we had taken this paragraph out earlier for Commissioner Von Spakovsky's benefit, that we will now have back in the reporting requirement paragraph.
Very good. And this, yes, it would make clear that in agenda document 07-76B, your motion, were it to be adopted, would include the language that now appears on page 3 of that agenda document from lines 18 to lines 20, and that those would also be incorporated into the language in draft document B of 07-76. Have I fairly characterized your motion, Madam Secretary? Was I sufficiently clear? Excellent. And again, for those who are not well-versed in our regulatory structure, the consequence of this would be that the reporting regime would apply to communications which were exempt from the electioneering communications provisions pursuant to the Supreme Court's decision, and the regulatory regime that appears in draft B would be the one that would apply. Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, I believe going along with that motion, it might be in order to authorize counsel's office to
technical and conforming amendments.
Technical and conforming, it might need a little bit of renumbering of paragraphs.
Okay, very good. And I trust, Commissioner Weintraub, you would.
I am absolutely in favor of technical and conforming amendments.
Very good.
I flunked outlining school, so I need help on that.
Okay. Discussions on the motion. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had supported Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion to place this in the section of the regulations which would have the effect of not requiring reporting. I am also going to support this motion for two reasons. One is that while I think the deleting the reporting requirement would be the better choice, more consistent with the limitations of imposed by the Constitution on the statute and our operation under it, it was clear that the Supreme Court did not expressly address the reporting requirements. Mr. Bob's challenge to the law explicitly reserved the reporting requirements and said he wasn't challenging them And while I think the best reading of the Supreme Court opinion would imply that those should fall too, it was clearly not directly addressed. I say that, that relief wasn't requested, and the court did not grant it. And so I don't think we're doing anything improper, at least in terms of the Supreme Court opinion, in adopting this as it is, and because I view the regulation as an improvement over no regulation for other reasons, the ability to challenge the reporting requirements, of course, is open to any plaintiff that wants to bring that challenge. And if I'm right about the best reading of the opinion, then that that ruling will ensue. And it will be simple enough to move the requirements at that time. I also want to point out that the requirements have been written in a way that will allow corporations who don't normally segregate their monies to go ahead and make these communications and have a practical way of reporting, in essence, the corporate fisc as the source of funds. And if it were not for that accommodation, I wouldn't be able to vote for reporting because I'm not quite sure. We talked about this in the case of a for-profit corporation. Do they report their last 100 customers, or you know, just what might be done? And labor unions, I take it, perhaps would have even more serious problems in terms of whether they would report dues payers or just what they might do. And so I think the fact that this is an arguable reading in an area that it can be argued, and that the proposal accommodates the special circumstances of corporations, that while I'm reluctant to vote for it, I'm willing to vote for it.
Very good. Other discussion on Commissioner Weintraub's motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Madam Secretary, if you can record that Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-1, with myself, the Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub and Commissioner Walther voting in favor, and Commissioner Von Spakovsky voting against. Any other discussion on this matter? Very good. The last I'm sorry. Just as a procedural step, the next things that will be going on here is that we will be preparing an explanation and justification for the reasons why we have adopted these rules, and we will circulate that and vote that out, at which point we will have an entire document that is available for publication in the Federal Register. In all likelihood, we will probably post something on the web before then, just to provide people with a document clearer than what they were able to pencil together, combining all of our motions today. But the formal legal steps will involve both the issuance of an E&J, as Commissioner Weintraub was indicating, and a vote thereon. So that is what we will be doing here on this as well. Other discussion on this matter? Very good. The last matter on our agenda involves management and administrative matters. Ms. Clark, are there any such matters to discuss today?
No, Mr. Chairman, there are none.
Very good. With that, I bring the meeting to a close. Thank you.